Well, greetings once again to all of Greater Turdville. It is Thursday, September the 8th, which means if it's Thursday, it must be time for an A to A. And with everything going on in the world, gosh, it's just there's so much going on. It's hard to keep track of everything. But one guy that I'm pretty sure does keep track of everything is my old buddy Denver Dave, Dave Kranzler, who obviously lives in Salt Lake City. Anyway, what perfect time to bring Dave back in. I mean, we'll have Dave remind everybody of his background, which is just, I mean, very valuable for the times we live in. But he currently writes Great Side Investment Research Dynamics. He runs a precious metals fund. He's got two subscription programs called the Short Sellers Journal and the Mining Stock Journal that everybody, especially in times like this, boy, those are two things that you should be journaling about. And this is our chance to pepper him with questions from you, the loyal TFMR subscribers. So, Dave, thank you very much for spending some time with us again today.
Thanks for having me on, Turd. I love doing this show. It's one of the funnest and most informative ones out there.
Oh, gosh. Thank you. That just because you're being polite doesn't mean I'm going to be any nicer to the Broncos. Still, I'm just glad they finally got that fossil out to pasture, and it leaves you with like this reject from Northwestern playing quarterback tonight, right? And I mean, what? Hey, you're the like second string quarterback, aren't you, Dave? Behind that guy.
You know, it's interesting. I'm wondering if I could throw the ball as far as he can. At least we know he's smart. He went to Northwestern, right?
I suppose. Yeah, that could be for what it's worth, but you know. Well, we'll just have to see. It's going to be an interesting year. But for everybody listening, this is our thing we do every week. We use this GoToWebinar control panel so that all of you can submit questions for the guest. There is a tab on your GoToWebinar control panel that you click and you type in a question. And eventually, after I get done peppering with Dave with my own questions, we'll get to yours. So just stack them up in queue as we go. But Dave, if you're ready, before we dive right in, tell everybody about your background. Remind them what your expertise is, where you come from, and tell them everybody a little bit about your service.
Sure. Okay. I kind of, right after college, I went to Wall Street and I worked at Goldman Sachs for a couple years. I was in the fixed income division there. And so I got to see that place from the inside. It was when Goldman Sachs was still a private partnership. And so, and that was very, very interesting, and I learned a lot. And then I went and I worked for a real small sole proprietor LBO firm, and that was for 2 years. And then I went to business school, and when I came out, it was right after Drexel Burnham had collapsed, and everyone was predicting the demise of the junk bond market. So, of course, I went into junk bond sales and trading.
Yeah, good timing.
And I did that for 9 years. With Bankers Trust, and Bankers Trust was acquired by Deutsche Bank, and after spending about 3 months at Deutsche Bank, I decided to pull the ripcord because I really didn't want to work for them. And it was right at the peak of the tech and internet bubble, and I thought for sure when the tech and internet bubble popped that New York and Wall Street would crash, and I was right for a while, but I was wrong about Alan Greenspan, you know, pressing the monetary and credit accelerator and reflating the whole system by inflating a housing bubble. So that was kind of a bad call on my part, but it was a good call because I moved back to Denver, where I'm from, in 2000, and I dove headfirst into the precious metals and mining stock world in 2001, and that's kind of what I've been doing ever since. And I started off with originally a blog called The Golden Truth, and that morphed into Investment Research Dynamics, and it was basically, I originally started it in lieu of spending money on a psychiatrist once a week, right? Because with insane as everything is, and it got even more insane after 2008, I thought I was going crazy. So after hitting my head against the wall for several months, I was like, you know what, I just got to write about this and get my frustrations out. And that's kind of how the blogs were born. And in December, In 2008, some partners and I launched a precious metals and mining stock fund, and it did well until 2011, and then it almost crashed and burned. And we managed to hang on to it, and we've had phenomenal returns since the start of this year. So, I mean, even with this latest pullback, we've had some really strong returns, and a lot of it's just because of our junior mining stock selections. And then, as you know, at some point, this stock market's got to start crashing again. I don't care how much money the Fed prints, and I don't care how hard they work to hold it up. It's got to crash. So I rolled out the Short Sellers Journal in early December, and those picks did really well until mid-February, when that's when they really started jumping in and propping up the stock market. Interestingly, for the last 4 weeks now, my picks have started to work right out of the gate, and I think that says a lot about what's going on underneath for the market that's underneath the Dow and the S&P 500. And in early March, I rolled out the sister publication, the Mining Stock Journal, and I try to find junior mining stocks that are off the radar screen, a lot of them end up being sort of exploration stocks, and so far most of the picks have way outperformed the GDXJ, and some of my picks, since, you know, in the time period that I've made them, have actually outperformed JNUG, which is the three times
nice.
The junior mining stock index. So I attribute most of that to luck, but I like to think some of it's based on knowledge and experience.
And your fund, is that open to like accredited investors, stuff like that? Is that anything that anybody can get involved in? I don't even know myself.
Oh yeah. It's an accredited investor. You have to meet the accredited investor net worth or income tests. And it's a private fund, although it's registered with a couple states, including Colorado. And we have a minimum investment. If anyone's interested in hearing more about it, they feel free to email me at dkranzler62@gmail.com.
Fair enough. Well, my friend, you mentioned one of the things I want to talk to you about is that background you had at Bankers Trust and it's purchased by Deutsche Bank, which is something that is, you know, kind of made Deutsche Bank the derivative cesspool that it has become, and you are privy to all that. You know well and good about all of that. Deutsche Bank now also struggling because of negative interest rates. And so I don't know if you have any more thoughts about. We've all been watching Deutsche Bank struggle all year long, be propped up, you know, and their size, their derivative book. Is this something you still think is a potential dead weight, bring down the whole European financial system and then, you know, pull over into the U.S. at some point?
That's actually a really interesting question, because I actually think derivatives brought down the whole system in 2008.
Right.
And I think we started to collapse, and the only reason we didn't collapse is you had this coordination of trillions of central bank money printing that occurred. And that, to me, that's what's been holding up the system. And you're starting to see calls for more QE, and have been seeing calls for more QE. Obviously, Japan's, they're sort of doing their own thing. They just sort of print money and lower interest rates whenever they see fit. So I don't know how coordinated they are per se, other than it's connected to the dollar yen manipulation that you've done a great job detailing and showing the correlation between that and the of the U.S. stock market and the price of gold. I think there's kind of an ongoing collapse, and I think it's in slow motion, and I think that if they don't engage at some point in another round of massive money printing, you know, which they slap lipstick on that pig by calling it quantitative easing,
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see another market collapse, you know, global market collapse. And as you pointed out, the foundation of that collapse is this world of derivatives. And they've purposely been made complicated. The accounting has been made complicated. and they've made the disclosures on what's going on with derivatives as opaque as possible. And they did that intentionally because derivatives have been the primary money-making machine for these banks since the late 90s.
To today.
Right, exactly. And if you remember in 2008, you know, Congress made this big thing about cleaning up the derivatives and limiting the use of them. Well, all they did was allow that they changed accounting rules so that the banks could make their use of derivatives even harder to figure out and easier for the banks to hide. And to answer your question about Deutsche Bank, I mean, Deutsche Bank specifically bought Bankers Trust, one for its derivatives and two for its high yield. And at the time, Deutsche Bank was one of the pioneering banks in derivatives. I mean, I was there in the early 90s when Deutsche Bank blew up part of Procter & Gamble with derivatives. And that was back in the time when, you know, working at Procter & Gamble, when you came out of business school, if you didn't go to a big consulting firm like Bain or McKinsey, or you didn't go to a big Wall Street firm, you know, if you were a marketing guy, getting a job at Procter & Gamble was just as prestigious as any of the Wall Street or consulting jobs. And so, you know, Procter & Gamble was kind of like a protected company. And here comes Deutsche Bankers Trust with their derivatives, and they blow up part of their Procter & Gamble's financials. And Deutsche Bank got, you know, severely, I mean, not Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust got severely bitch slapped for it. I remember that. I remember it specifically because we all thought on the junk bond desk that the derivatives, that this situation was going to bring down all of capital markets. And of course, we were only worried about our bonuses, but
Course.
they saved that thing. They got rid of Charlie Sanford, who was the CEO at the time, and they brought in this guy, Frank Newman, who was a Fed official, and he was a Clinton administration lackey. And he was sort of there, brought in as a regular, you know, for regulatory purposes. And they cleaned up Bankers Trust, and Deutsche Bank was over in the United States trying to break into capital markets and corporate finance in a big way. And they really wanted to become the leader in derivatives, and so that's why they bought Bankers Trust. And they, you know, Frank Newman never really cleaned up the underlying fraud in derivatives at Bankers Trust. I mean, I can attest to that because we were engaging in fraudulent derivatives activities on the high yield desk. I mean, I remember filling out ISDA forms, you know, that would help us hide junk bond positions from what we called the risk Nazis, the back office risk Nazis at Bankers Trust. Yeah, and so, I mean, essentially, Deutsche Bank took the structure of derivatives that was founded at Bankers Trust, and they just went wild with it.
And here we are today.
Right. And that's the whole thing. I mean, no one really knows exactly how dangerous Deutsche Bank's derivatives exposures are. And, you know, even when they went through that period where they got rid of this guy Anshu Jain, who I actually met when Deutsche Bank took over Bankers Trust. And this is the type of guy, like, I literally, after I shook his hand and the meeting was over, I literally went home and took a shower and had to change my suit. That's how greasy I felt. And this guy was as sleazy as they come. And he rode the derivatives wave, and all the money that Deutsche Bank was making off of derivatives, and was elevated to CEO. And then he was obviously canned last year, pretty much 2 weeks after he's given more responsibility. And that's when I think something really bad happened there. And I think that something bad thing has been going on ever since. And I think that the Fed has been working with the ECB and the Bundesbank to try and make sure that Deutsche Bank doesn't collapse. Because I think if the central bank stepped out of the way, I think Deutsche Bank would collapse, and you'd probably trigger a systemic collapse. You know, that would be global in nature. That's how ugly I think this derivatives problem really is.
Well, let me take that off in a different direction then, because I've already got several questions piling up in queue, so I probably better get to the first one that I have then for you.
I probably put people to sleep with that too, because it's kind of a dry subject.
What?
I
What? Sorry. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Let me get back to where we were. Okay. Anyway, you wrote about something last night, and I just kind of quickly get your thoughts on behind this, because I have another question I want to ask you about some of the stuff you've been writing about. But specifically, this Deutsche Bank gold note ETF thingy. When this news hit last week, there were people out there calling it a failure delivery, and I was like, I don't know. It kind of has a hint of one. It might kind of, but we got to get more details. And then I talked to Eric Sprott on our weekly thing last Friday, and he was like, I don't think this is anything. I mean, it almost reads to me like some cat walked into a local branch of Deutsche Bank and demanded that the branch give him gold, which is like they're not going to have gold. But anyway, and then you wrote something about this last night. Could you just kind of take just a couple of minutes and tell everybody what you think that is all about?
Sure. It's actually, and I've got the securities is called Zetra Gold, and it's actually a note. And I finally went through the prospectus. I had been meaning to do that because everyone was pointing their fingers at Deutsche Bank saying, oh, Deutsche Bank committed fraud, they failure to deliver gold, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. What does
Right.
the prospectus say? And so I finally went through it, and I actually have a good friend who's an attorney, and we discussed a lot of the things that are in the prospectus.
What do you decide?
And first of all, Deutsche Bank is only part of this whole deal. The actual issuer is an entity called Deutsche Börse, and all Deutsche Börse is an LLC, the German version of an LLC. And it doesn't have any assets in it other than it has, it's the issuer of these notes.
Right. Okay.
And there's the investors in this LLC are companies that it's like Deutsche Bank, which is the redemption agent for the notes or one of them. There's a the custodian is an entity called Clearstream Banking. It's some German bank. I didn't really look up to see what they were. I just assumed they owned a vault where they keep gold, presumably. And the ultimate, I guess the ultimate guarantor of the gold is a company called Unicore, which is a Swiss refining and metals trading firm. And other than that, I mean, if you go through the prospectus, it's just one giant legal disclaimer.
Sure.
And the only thing that you have as a note holder is you have the right to apply for delivery of gold. But nowhere in the prospectus does it ever say that you're going to be guaranteed of getting delivery of gold. I mean, I've never seen a prospectus with this many disclaimers and this many loopholes in it. I mean, it's looser than the GLD prospectus. I was just, when I read through this, my jaw was dropping. And Deutsche Bank is the redemption agent. So yeah, you can fill out your paperwork and take it to the bank and say, hey, I want my Zetra gold notes, I want my gold. All they have to do is pass it on, and it doesn't even say who they pass it on to. I assume they pass it on to either Clearstream or Unicore, but there's not even provisions in there for exactly how that process is supposed to work.
It's not really a delivery failure as it was, so many people were screaming last week, as it is just another exposure, really, of, these things are Swiss cheese, man. There's so many holes in them, and there's so many mirrors, and I mean, it's smoke, and it's all meant to kind of deceive and give the appearance that everything's above board when really it's just more of the same.
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, and it says in here, Deutsche Bank is not in any way obliged to protect the interests of the investors. That's right in the prospectus in a couple spots. And in fact, that disclaimer is connected to every single entity that's involved in Deutsche Börse.
It's like
And
a
it's
big serpent.
says right in the prospectus. I've never seen this.
Just
It
like.
says blatantly, all of the third parties involved in Deutsche Börse are doing this to make money.
It's kind of like a big circle jerk. I mean, it's like you can fill out your paperwork and go into Deutsche Bank and said, I'd like my gold. And then they're going to hand it to somebody else who goes, well, this isn't our job. And then they're going to hand it to somebody else who says, well, that's not our job either. It's just like, right?
Right, that's exactly right. And so ultimately, I guess if you took this to court, the ultimate the ultimate entity that would be responsible for making good on your claim for gold or your right to apply to exchange the notes for gold is this Unicorp, because they are the debtor of the gold delivery claims.
And they're Swiss.
And it's right, and they're Swiss.
Yeah, good
but there's a disclaimer in the prospectus, and it says that Unicorp, in its capacity as debtor of the gold delivery claims, will be actively trading in gold, and that this activity may also lead to various potential and actual conflicts of interest. Unicorp is not obliged to decide any such conflict of interest in favor of the investors, but will, in connection with the trading in gold, take such decisions and measures at its sole discretion as it may deem necessary or expedient to protect its own interests, and will act in this context as if the notes, that is those, you know, the notes that you bought, did not even exist. So if they don't feel like delivering you gold, if this basically says they don't have to because it may be in conflict with their interests.
With the hedging and whatever they're doing. Yeah, their own.
Well, I mean, and ultimately, Craig, I mean, what this could mean and is that, you know, they don't have the gold to deliver. They're probably busy refining gold and sending it to India and China, and we know that game is going on.
Right.
And they may not actually have the gold in there. You know, all they have are paper claims to gold that they're supposed to have. But this disclaimer says, hey, if it's a conflict of interest and hurts us, we're not going to deliver you the gold. We don't have to. We have that legal right. It's right there in the prospectus.
Same old BS. Same old BS.
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is way worse than the GLD prospectus.
And no one, you said somebody, if somebody wants to sue them, you'd have to be a fool. So why would you want, just sell the damn note to whomever and then go buy yourself some physical gold someplace? Why would you want to jack around suing to get, I mean, it'll allow this whole scheme to just continue.
And that's exactly right. I mean, and again, the bottom line here is, If you buy paper gold thinking you can eventually convert it into gold, you're badly mistaken, because
idiot.
These prospectuses are all written with outs in them so that they don't have to deliver you the gold.
Yeah.
And my belief, and it's always been ever since Jim Turk did the first dissection of the original GLD prospectus in 2004, is that these paper gold ETFs, and this is actually a note, it's not even an ETF, these paper gold securities are designed to trap money that would otherwise be used to buy physical gold for delivery.
Exactly. 100% correct. All right. Hey, let me, gosh, we're already 20 minutes into this, Dave. Time flies and we're having fun. Let me, I better move on to the one, I guess I'm going to kind of bunch all these into just one question I've had from people that couldn't join us today. You know, people always type questions onto the site and send me emails and stuff. And all of the ones I've gotten have all had to deal with stuff you've written lately about Rickards and Jim Rickards. And you and I have spoken about this quite a bit online and offline. But I'm going to kind of come at you with a different direction, because I think most everybody knows how you feel, but you can obviously repeat it if you'd like. But the curious part about this, and this is where the questions were going, does it strike you a little odd that this dude all of a sudden is kind of being date and time specific? Because he's put out a number of things that have said September 30th, you know, and the yuan goes into the SDR in October and all that kind of stuff. And he's kind of like my old stockbroker adage, you know, you never wanted to give date and price in the same sentence, you know? It's like, yeah, I know I said Walmart's going to 60, but that's entirely different than saying Walmart's going to 60 by Christmas. And here's Rickards now saying, you know, I mean, he's kind of putting a little bit of credibility on the line by saying September 30th is going to be a big date. Does that, anyway, ultimately, I think the question, the sense of the question from what was sent to me was, does him doing that change your opinion or affect what you think of his, what he's trying to do with his books and everything else?
Not really. I mean, is anyone going to hold him accountable to that? If I don't even know what he says is going to happen on September 30th, but is anyone going to hold him accountable to that publicly if all of a sudden September 30th comes and goes and nothing happens?
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, people have to remember that. Yeah.
I think it's a marketing ploy by him. I mean, my understanding is I think he has like a Doesn't he have some sort of subscription service through
Yeah.
Agora or something?
Yes, he has that now as well.
And I've read, I don't, I haven't even looked into it, but my understanding is it's pretty expensive.
I'm sure it is because, you
And
know.
so for him to hang claims out there like that, it's just a marketing device. It
Like
keeps the
Bull Coleman.
audience captive.
Like,
And
go
I'm
ahead.
sure if his predictions are wrong, whatever they are, he can backpedal them. And I don't even know that no one holds these guys accountable anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
Like,
I stand by my claim that he is essentially a front man for the deep state. And I had a dinner meeting with a guy a couple of years ago, and this guy's really started to pull off the grid, but he's been involved in the precious metals world since the mid-70s. And he's been on, bullion dealer ethics boards. I mean, this guy is, he's been doing this for a lot longer than any of us have. And he's well connected, and some of the stories he has it's just incredible. But at any rate, he told me point blank, he said, look, this guy is a rep, he's a front for the Department of Defense. Everyone in the deep state knows the dollar is eventually toast, and they're trying to figure out a way to let that happen and yet still maintain, because the dollar is what gives these guys political and economic control of basically the globe, right?
right.
Well, they want the SDR as the replacement because the dollar is still, and I don't remember what the percentage is, it changes day to day, but I think the dollar right now, before they throw the won in there, is something like, I think it's at least 50% of the SDR. And so if the SDR is inserted in place of the dollar as the next reserve currency, it still gives these guys a lot of control, right?
Yeah,
Because it's
no, that's
the
right.
dollar is, yeah. And so that's the point. That's why he's been out there for several years now, humping the SDR as the next replacement. And I think it's just one of these things. Yeah, he's an advocate of gold, but that's kind of like, that's his bait. Come on in, the water's warm. I'm on your side. I'm a gold advocate. But you really want the SDR. The
Right.
SDR is nothing more than another fiat currency.
Yeah, because it's a basket of them, for crying out loud.
And I'm not the only one who's raised these, who's made these allegations against him, and I've never heard him defend it.
No, nobody, no. Well, and let's just leave it with the old adage, once a company man, always a company man, right?
Right, exactly.
All right. Let's move on to the questions I have in queue because I have several of them piling up, as I said. And again, if you have any questions of Dave, you want to ask him about the housing market, you want to ask him about any miners he follows, I mean anything, just type it into the questions tab that's on that GoToWebinar control panel that popped up on your screen when you logged in. Let's dive right in though. The first one in queue comes from Russ. And this kind of, I guess, plays into your expertise as a one guy that writes a short seller's journal and also runs a hedge fund in a sense. There's this guy based out of New York who's apparently likes to drive drunk and snort coke and all that kind of stuff. And in the meantime, he also runs a fund where he goes out and does these drive-by assassinations of companies. And he turned his sights on First Majestic Silver last week and was at least partly responsible for moving First Majestic down from 19 to 11. Russ's question is, what do you think of the drive-by, as he calls it, drive-by assassination of First Majestic? And does it, I guess, change your view of the company, or what do you think of the company?
That's a good question. I'm familiar with that. I have some of his research calls on shorting stocks. I haven't had a chance to read any of his work, and I've been meaning to do it. And I didn't read through what he had to say about First Majestic. And the reason for that is simply just because we don't own it in the fund, and I don't own it personally.
There you go.
When First Majestic took over Silvercrest Mines, we owned a big position in Silvercrest. I was so bummed when they took them over, and I knew they were getting a great deal on Silvercrest. They bought that thing cheap, and we were given part of it. The terms of the deal was, we received cash plus AG stock, and I think our basis in the stock was about $2 or $2.50, and I sold it out at 9 and bought some juniors. And clearly, I sold it too soon because went a lot higher. Again, without knowing what his criticisms are of First Majestic, I mean, what I would say, my view on First Majestic, obviously Keith Neumeier is, you know, he's one of the, probably one of the more brilliant mining company operators out there. He's very savvy. I think he's very bright. I do think that First Majestic had gotten ahead of itself in terms of valuation when it ran up to, I don't know, I think it peaked out at 18 or 19.
Yeah.
It's back down to 13. So I think in terms of what First Majestic has, and that we, you know, that we know what they have through their disclosures, it might have gotten a little bit overvalued relative to some of its comps. And to me, the best closest comp is Tahoe. T-A-H-O is the ticker. And but I mean, I just know what they have when they bought Silvercrest, and I know that Silvercrest has a lot more silver that's in the ground that they just haven't uncovered yet because they're still drilling it. I assume that a lot of the other properties First Majestic owns, again, I've never really taken a close look at First Majestic. I think when you buy First Majestic, you're also buying an expectation that down the road he's going to make really good acquisitions at good prices like he did with Silvercrest. And so, you know, again, I don't know what this cocaine guy's criticisms were of First Majestic, but I wouldn't chase First Majestic when it goes higher, but now that I'm looking at it, down at 13, if you think silver is going to go higher from here, which obviously I think everyone on this conference call does, or the webinar does, it's probably not a bad trading buy here.
Yeah, and that was the guy's main point was he was like, Keith Neumeier actually thinks silver is going to go higher. So he thinks, well, yeah. He makes all these claims, you know, that silver is going, you know, to 40 or 50 and that the markets are manipulated. Okay.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, silver is going at least back to 50 before everything blows up, right?
Exactly.
I think it is. So if you take all the silver that First Majestic has, that's just take their collective 43101 silver resource. And again, I don't know how big that is. I know how big Silvercrest is, and I know how big Silvercrest potentially is. It's Silvercrest that they, you know, potentially has 5 to 10 times the amount of silver that it had disclosed when First Majestic took it over. But at any rate, if you take $50 an ounce for silver, yeah, and value First Majestic based on how much silver it has in the ground, I mean, tell me what number you come up with. Right. I guarantee it puts that stock probably closer to $100 a share.
He has told me twice. I have asked him twice in two separate interviews this year. He's given me the same answer both times on the record. I said, you know, you mine, let's call it 20 million ounces of silver, and the price of silver goes up a dollar, how much of that $20 million flows through the bottom line? He said 90%.
Right.
So if silver goes to 30, I mean, that's $180 million extra to the company. I mean, so anyway, we'll just leave it at that. I mean, I just the drive-by shootings that these hedge fund guys do like that, you know, I'm sure this guy was shorting it, you know, down from 19. And then all of a sudden he puts out this summary after he's already made money to try to get some more sellers so he can buy his back.
Right. That's the game.
He can feed his coke habit that way. And if it sounds like the guy was arrested back in August, driving on Long Island, drunk driving and in possession of coke, this guy that put out the research report. So I'm not just making this shit up. Okay. Ted has a question. He said, what are your thoughts about the safety? I mean, we talk about the big banks and all that kind of stuff, and he just, you know, and the risks involved there. But what are your thoughts on the safety of, you know, some of these electronic brokers, you know, like Scottrade, E-Trade, stuff like that during the next financial crisis? You know, a lot of people own miners and they hold them there in custody. What are your thoughts on that, on the safety of those companies, those online brokers?
That's a great question. And the reason why I mean, if you're going to, I think we kind of have to live our day-to-day life acting as if, It's not going to blow up tomorrow.
Right.
And so that means you're going to want to get involved in the markets. You're going to want to trade. And the only way to do that is to have a custodial brokerage account. And so in a sense, you're putting your money at risk based on the safety of the custodian. And these big banks that have online trading subsidiaries, I wouldn't go near those because those big banks are going to blow up. And based on the bail-in laws, if you have a brokerage account with these big banks, you might not get your money back.
Right.
I mean, we saw a preview of that with MH Global. But then you have these companies like, I wouldn't probably would stay away from E-Trade because there's no telling what's really going on there. I mean, Citadel basically owns it, and I don't trust Citadel.
No.
But is Scottrade, I'm not sure who owns that. I think you got to look and see who owns it. If Scottrade exists independently and the system blows up, I think you have a better chance of getting your money back than you do at a big bank or at a place like E-Trade. I use Fidelity and Schwab personally, and we use Schwab for our fund as the custodian. And it's just because they're not owned by a big bank, and presumably they don't have the derivatives and counterparty issues that these big banks have. So I think if we do have a bank holiday, the markets will close and your money may be stuck for a while, but I don't think that means that you won't be able to get it out from a place like Scottrade or Fidelity or Schwab.
Yeah,
so,
I remember people too. People worry about gold confiscation, all these other things. All of these things, when they happen, might catch 99% of the population, off guard. But anybody that reads this site or reads your site, I mean, at least you're going to have some warning that this is like, oh crap, this is really happening right now. It's not like anybody that reads our stuff, Dave, is going to like wake up on a Tuesday and go, oh shit, I didn't see that coming.
That's a good point. I mean, at the end of the day, I just tell people, look, if we go into a really ugly situation economically and politically, you're not going to be able to protect yourself anyway because the government's going to be able to do what they want.
Yeah. There are kind of two questions that kind of follow right up beyond that. And I think you mentioned, Clark, I had a question about which company do you use? And you mentioned Schwab, I think. That's what you use for
Schwab and Fidelity, yeah.
Your custodian broker. And you keep stocks in direct registration and street name? Or what's your plan in the event of a brokerage or bank insolvency?
That's interesting, too. And I get that question a lot. In fact, I answered it for someone yesterday. And while I understand the spirit of taking personal possession of your stock certificates, and I think it originally kind of, I think Sinclair basically was promoting that, and part of it was just so that hedge funds couldn't borrow the mining shares and short them.
Right.
Well, that's sort of, the fact that they don't go after naked shorting kind of got around that.
Yeah.
So it didn't. and my thing is that if we, I think it depends on whether you believe we're going to run into a period where I like to call it, what I call it is systemic continuity or systemic discontinuity. And if we go into systemic discontinuity and everything shuts down, it's not going to matter whether you have possession of your mining stock certificates or not. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to go up to Toronto and knock on the door of First Majestic and say, here's my shares. Can I have money for them?
Right.
They're probably not even going to answer the door. So, and I guess if you think that maybe we'll have a situation where we go into where everything shuts down and then it reopens and it's some form that's similar to what was going on before it shut down, and then maybe it's worthwhile having possession of your certificates. But for me, I personally like to have the instant liquidity it affords by having my certificates at the custodian held in street name. Because, I can go online right now, and if I want to sell stocks, I can sell it, get the cash, and wire it to my bank.
Right.
And you can't do that if you actually have possession of your certificates. It takes longer. It's just not as it's not as convenient. So my personal view is I don't think it's going to matter whether you have your certs or not in your personal possession when the inevitable happens. And I just think it's worth having liquidity of leaving leaving everything with the custodian.
I'd say far more important is having your physical precious metal in your personal possession when
That's 100% right there. I completely
you
agree.
can weather the storm. If it's 6 months before you've got liquidity in your Schwab account again or something, at least you've got, the metal. I don't know about you, but I've, don't tell anybody this, but I've been stockpiling cash too. At least a little bit. I'm not going, and I'm, it's not something over the top, with a safe full of $100 bills, but just a little bit, just in case there's a point where the ATMs don't work, and somebody doesn't want to take an ounce of silver. At least I can maybe give them a greenback and they'll give me a tank of gas or something,
Yeah, that's true, and I agree with that. And that was one of the original premises Sinclair had always said. He suggested keeping some dollars and some euros, but I would just keep dollars. But I actually think that if we go into that situation where it becomes relevant that you actually are sitting on physical gold and silver and some cash, I think gold and silver are going to be freely traded out there. I don't think you're going to have a problem. In fact, it may even be easier to use than cash.
Yeah, I would agree with you. All right, I got two questions left. This one, I don't know if you have any specific comments on this or not, actually on either of these. Rob wants to know, as we were talking about these online brokers, do you consider TD Ameritrade associated with part of a big bank? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's isn't it part of isn't there TD Toronto Dominion Bank?
I have no idea. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's a subsidiary of I think it's called Toronto Dominion Bank. In fact, when I was a junk bond trader, they were one of the few non-US banks involved in trading junk bonds. So yeah, TD Ameritrade. Let me just look it up here. I
Nice.
haven't thought that one for a while. Yeah, it's TD Bank Group. It's Toronto Dominion Bank. And so TD Ameritrade is a subsidiary of that.
Take that for what it's worth, that's for sure. I think everybody probably ought to factor that into their decision making as to whether they want to have an account there.
And I don't, and we've looked into TD Ameritrade, so that we could see if we could have direct access to the TSX instead of buying
Yeah.
OTC bulletin board junior mining stocks. And you can't do that, which amazed me. I mean, here's a subsidiary of of a Toronto bank, and presumably this bank trades on the Canadian exchanges, but they don't give TD Ameritrade users direct access to the TSX. So I honestly don't see any reason to use TD Ameritrade over Fidelity. I mean, Fidelity, you can move money between Fidelity and your bank here with the mouse click.
Yeah. All right. And then I've just got, at least at this point, and then we'll begin to wrap up, two kind of more specific minor questions. One has to do with Sandstorm Gold, and I guess that's SAND, and just kind of your general thoughts on this, those streamer royalty companies.
Sandstorm is another one that I've never really taken a specific look at, and part of the reason is it's so well covered out there by newsletter writers and Bay Street and Wall Street analysts that I don't know that I necessarily would bring any value added to looking at it. I will say that most of these streamers are I think that a lot of their upside is priced in, at least in the context of where gold and silver are right now.
The current price,
I
yeah.
think the streamers that have actually, and again, I don't know how much of Sandstorm streaming deals are actually current pay versus they've got all these streaming deals that kick in when the company's mines actually get up and operating. I just don't know enough to speak intelligently about that. So
Fair enough.
I think streamers are an interesting way to index. You can have a leveraged index of the price of gold and silver.
Yeah.
If so, and but I do think that with careful research, and if you get a little bit lucky and you pick the right junior exploration stocks, that's where the most upside is in the mining stock sector. And I got lucky with a company called Silvercrest Metals, and that was a spin-off from Silvercrest Mines when First Majestic took over Silvercrest Mines. There was a specific property there that I knew about that I knew had huge potential, and the existing management of Silvercrest that didn't make the jump over to First Majestic took over this new entity called Silvercrest Metals. And I had actually featured it in my short seller's journal on January 10th. It was before I had the mining stock journal, and I knew this thing was going to be a huge home run, and it was at 16 cents when I put it in my short seller's journal. And they've released a series of just extraordinary drilling results. And the stock is at 287 now. So it went from 16 cents to 287 since January 10th.
That'll work.
And so that's an example. And that, again, a lot of that is luck, but it also, I knew that this property was going to be a home run property. And quite frankly, I think that the logical step is going to be for First Majestic to take over Silvercrest Metals
Right
in this.
there, yeah, probably. Hey, and
Yeah.
Clark I had a follow-up question about that, and I accidentally deleted it. So, Clark I, if you're out there, what was that company? Type it in again, whatever that question was you had for Dave, because it's right along those same lines. And it would have been a perfect segue for crying out loud. Oh, here we go. Kootenay Silver. Do you know anything about Kootenay Silver?
Is that in Australia? Is that the, in
Yeah, well,
Australia?
Clark, can type in a little more about, if you would, because it has something to do with Silver Crest and all that kind of jazz. While they have similar properties in Mexico as Silver
Have to
Crest.
take a look at it. I'm actually not familiar with it, but I'll have to take a look at it.
All right. And the last question I had comes from Sean, and this kind of gets back to one other thing I wanted to ask you about anyway. So we'll call it a day after this one, and we'll get to the final four. What are your thoughts on the real estate market, Dave? And what will they be doing? You know, if we get this kind of blowout in gold and silver and a reset, you know, and people talk about, you know, maybe the one thing you do with your metal is you buy other hard assets like real estate. So will real estate rise with inflation, or is it just so overvalued at this point that it can't? Or what are your just general thoughts? And then we'll wrap up.
I think real estate's going to crash again. I mean, what's driven this real estate bubble has been debt and
Right,
credit.
right.
And so your value of your real estate is a function of how much debt you can take out to pay the price that's being asked for it. And since everyone who's buying real estate can take out debt, it then becomes a race to see who can take out more debt. And the government made it easier to take out more debt when they took down the Fannie and Freddie down payment requirements from 5% to 3%. And there's actually some Fannie and Freddie programs that are 0% down payment. Yeah, I mean, it's absurd.
Like a 10-year car loan.
Right, exactly. And people say there hasn't been any price inflation out there. Well, yeah, maybe not in a box of cereal, but housing and real estate have gone through huge price and had gone through a huge price inflation period. And so, yeah, maybe unlevered real estate after a crash is gonna be a great inflation hedge. But the inflation that's hit the housing market is already way outrun the general rate of inflation. So if you were gonna make that trade, you should have done it 5 years ago. Of
Nice.
course, who could have foreseen that this housing bubble was going to get blown up with as much debt as it did the last time around? Because, everyone would have thought that the Fed and the government learned their lesson the first time. Well, no, they didn't. And so, yeah, I think maybe after this next real estate crash, I think a lot of the cash that's earmarked for real estate is going to go into precious metals when the crash starts to happen again. So after the crash, yeah.
Yeah.
When prices get beaten down 70 or 80%, yeah, then you sell your metal and you buy unlevered real estate.
Yeah, I can see where that's part of a sound strategy, or at least some, you know, the part of the exit
You
strategy.
know, we're actually already starting to see real estate crash happen on the fringes, and the fringes being the very high-end areas. I wrote an article about this, I don't know, about 3 weeks ago. Prices in places like the Hamptons and Aspen, are down 50%. Transaction volume and prices at the high end are down 50%.
Yeah.
And sales volume in July, there's an outfit called Redfin that put out a report for July, and transaction volume, you know, in a lot of the bubble areas like Vegas and Denver and Portland, transaction volume's been down as much as, you know, in Denver it was down 11% in July. In Vegas it was down almost 50%. So that what's becoming a crash at the high end is starting to infiltrate into the middle level in a lot of areas. Miami, same thing. If you look at some of the cities in Miami and Florida that were published in this report, they're down 20-30% in July from July 2015. So it's starting to happen again, and you know the media is going to try and make everyone believe that it isn't happening, but it's happening, and I think it's going to happen a lot more quickly than people are expecting.
Well, all right, my friend, you know what this means. It's time for us to begin wrapping up. You've been extraordinarily generous with your time. And boy, this is going to be very popular as people listen to it tonight. And then we'll make it public over the weekend tomorrow. But Dave, you know what that means. If we're at the end of the road, it's time for the final four.
I don't know if I look forward to this or I dread it.
I know it's my favorite part. I have to sit there and listen to your drivel for 45 minutes just so I can get to the
surprised you didn't nod off.
That's why I had an extra cup of coffee. All right, you ready? As most everybody knows.
All that cocaine from that Hamptons short seller.
That's right. As most everybody knows, Denver Dave lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I'm reminded of that. What was it? One of those Naked Gun movies where they were talking about the boxers, you know? And they're like, oh, yeah, the Boston Glover. Yeah, yeah, he's from Louisville. And, you know, remember all that? Anyway, you're a resident of Colorado, the great state of Colorado, as some people call it at least. Football season kicks off tonight. Football season kicks off tonight. So, you know, I'm going to ask you about your beloved Broncos. How many wins will the Fighting Donkeys put in the win column this year?
Well, I can count two against the Kansas City Chiefs. I have Denver going 12-4 this year.
Oh, my gosh. That's with you playing quarterback, I understand. Okay.
Maybe my sister, who just turned 50.
Yeah, she could play. after Trevor Siemian. Okay, 12. I'm putting you down for 12. All right. I know another great passion of yours is tennis. I used to play golf. I used to know a guy in Nebraska, a great amateur golfer by the name of Larry Sock. You probably know where I'm going with this. Larry has a kid that grew up here in the Kansas City area. It was a local legend named Jack Sock. Is Jack Sock the next great American tennis player?
I thought he grew up in Nebraska. Did he grow up in Kansas
City? He grew up in Nebraska, but Larry sent him down to Kansas City. He went to high school down here so he could go to a tennis academy all the rest of the time. His wife lived down here so that they could – I mean, they were still married, but that was the sacrifice they went to so that he could work on his game. And apparently it's paying off at this point. But is Larry – I mean, is Larry. Larry's not going to be a great tennis player. He's got like half of an index finger, so that's always going to affect his forehand. But is Jack – the next great American tennis player?
You know, Jack has a very similar game with the last great American tennis player, who's also from Nebraska, a guy by the name of Andy Roddick. People may remember him.
Yeah.
Roddick's also a great golfer, but he's got a blistering serve. He's got one of the fastest serves on the tour. He's got his forehand has more topspin than Nadal's forehand, which is unbelievable. I think if he works on his net game and his backhand, I think within the next year or two, he should be a top 10 tennis player.
Could you stick your racket out and get it back over on his serve?
I got to be honest with you, Turd. I don't know that I would want to stand there and watch and have someone hit a 140-mile-an-hour serve at me. But I think the only way you could do that is hopefully – get a glimpse of the ball and stick your racket out there and block it back. And that's all anyone can do with that serve.
I can't even imagine 140 freaking miles an hour coming at you from, what is that, like a 120 feet away or something?
If that, yeah.
Jeez. All right.
And believe me, I mean, I've been hit with a ball going 100 miles an hour, and it does not feel good. It leaves a bruise on your body that's there for a couple weeks.
God. All right. As I mentioned, you are a very famous resident of the state of Colorado, so I got to ask you this. Do you prefer something called the Blue Dream, or would you rather have the Golden Goat?
Let me guess. That has something that Bill Clinton doesn't to do with what Bill Clinton never inhaled.
Yeah, or Barack Obama would be able to tell you which one he prefers. Okay.
They don't sell Maui Wowie at the dispensaries in Denver. Well, let's just say I'll not admit or deny anything, but if I were to partake in that, I like the gummy bear edibles, or I would like the gummy bear edibles.
Well, I actually saw, I don't know what I was watching, might have been football last week, and I saw a commercial for Men's One A Day gummy vitamins, and I thought, my God, we've finally been wussified to the, I mean, seriously, we need gummy vitamins for men?
I've seen those, I know, and at first I thought they were children's vitamins. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
Oh, God.
I will say, with regard to that other question, it is, you know, because, I mean, you basically grew up around the same time I did in the 70s and the 80s, and if you ever wanted to try and get a hold of weed, it was a whole experience, and you had to worry about getting caught, and it's the strangest thing to be able to just walk into a place, flash your ID, and you go in there, and the shelves are just full of this super powerful weed that, you know, you would have given your left testicle to get a hold of in college.
Exactly.
And it's just right there. And it's really kind of strange. And when you're driving through certain parts of Denver, they have these grow warehouses. You can actually smell the pot being grown when you drive by certain areas. It's really wild.
You smell a lot like the car of my buddy in high school that picks a bit and put it. To dry it out, he put it in his trunk because he knew his trunk was real hot, you know, during the summer. And so he picked it and put it in his trunk and thought that would dry it out over the course of a hot summer day. All it did was that didn't work out real well for him. All right, finally, by the next time we speak, provided we don't let's not put it that way. Let's say by 1 year from today, that's a better parameter. Who will be the president of the United States? Now, if you think about it, that's kind of a nuanced question. I didn't ask you an A or B answer. This is just who will be the president 1 year from today?
Barack Obama.
Oh, Daddy, now that's a thought-provoking answer right there. But since we're up against it after an hour, I'm just going to leave that one hanging. You can already see, though, all this stuff about the Russians. I mean, they're planting the seed to make, if Trump somehow wins, they're going to claim the whole thing's illegitimate and that the Russians made it so he won and all that. You can see that coming a mile away.
Exactly. Well, also, what happens if Hillary drops dead before the election?
Yeah. Well, that's just it. I mean, that's why I asked you, you know, it wasn't just an A-B Trump-Hillary. It's who will it be? Because there's all kinds of scenarios that could
that's right.
play out, especially even after the election. All right, my friend, I can't believe this went – I took an hour of your time. My gosh, I'm going to have to send you a bag of Doritos to go with all that weed that you smoke as a thank you. But
maybe
it's been great.
Gummy bear vitamins instead.
What's that?
Maybe I need the men's gummy bear vitamins instead.
There you go. Oh, you know, I'll send you some of those. Your time is valuable, and you shared so much with us. I really appreciate it. And I admit, I invite everybody, Investment Research Dynamic, it's got to be on your favorites list. And by all means, definitely consider Mining Stock Journal. If you're out there just trying to pick these things by yourself, yeah, it worked pretty well in February, but you know, it might be a little more challenging going forward. You need some help. Mining Stock Journal will do it. And man, just a matter of time, like you said, till the whole stock market begins to roll over. Short Sellers Journal will help you there. And invite everybody to check it out. Dave, thanks so much for your
time. Thanks for having me on. I'm surprised that I can't believe it's already been an hour. Yeah, but any time.
Well, hopefully the system will keep together long enough that we'll be able to do it again. Otherwise, I'll just, get on my bike and ride it out to Colorado and we'll do it again sometime. That way, if we have to. David, all the best, my friend. Hang in there, and thanks again for everything.
Thanks, Kurt.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll do this again next week.